Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined this week by Frank Cagliano, who's sitting on my couch and not doing it remotely from someplace far and yon, as he has been back from his travels. Welcome back, Frank.
Thank you, David. I'm back.
It's good to do the show with us together.
It is.
All right, so the big news this week...
Well, there's a lot of news this week.
A lot of news. Okay. Among the news this week has been the testimony... Of Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg talking about the Cambridge Analytica leak and the various ways in which Facebook is monitoring all of our data. Earlier this week, or I guess it was last week, there was a big news story about the Trump administration announcing that they're going to have a new question on the census asking about citizenship and whether who in the household is a citizen. And so I thought this week we would talk about data and who has our data and who is watching us and who knows all of our secrets. So that's the topic for the week. But Frank, before we get into all of that, we have a correction from our previous episode, or an apology.
We have an apology and a correction, and I have to confess, as the words were coming out of my mouth, I knew this was going to happen. You may recall, dear listeners, that at the end of last week's episode...
For all of those people who are listening all the way to the end of the episodes...
we discussed Leif Erikson Day, and David quizzed me about Leif Erikson's exploration of North America, and we got both the date and the location wrong. The date of Leif Erikson's alleged discovery, and I'm using air quotes for discovery because discovery is a problematic term, but the approximate date of Leif Erikson's arrival, let's say, in North America is around the year 1000. So we had that wrong. And also, and I knew this, and so I'm kicking myself, he arrived in Newfoundland, not in Nova Scotia. I had Nova Scotia on the brain because it was Tartan Week. We're very grateful to a listener, John Matthew, who sent us a very kind message correcting us about this. John wrote to us from Canada. And I, as we ended the recording last week, David, and of course we did so remotely, I thought, we've got that wrong, and somebody's going to call that to our attention. So we're grateful to John both for listening and for being very kind and gracious in pointing out our mistake, yes. And we apologize for our mistake.
Yes. Yeah, so we do apologize, and for those people who were under illusions that we did this with deep research and scripts before we record, I don't know what you're thinking, because this is clearly not scripted show. Right, so back to data. I think if you're talking about data being collected, people's individual data being collected, I think a good place to start is with the census. And the U.S. has the first census in 1790. Frank, you want to give us the background to why we have a first census in 1790?
Yeah, well, Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, drafted in 1787, ratified in 1789. Ratified in 1788, taking effect in 1789. States representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers. Clause goes on in ways we may get into, but that's the key to it. It also stipulates that the enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States in 1789 and within every subsequent term of 10 years in such manner as they shall by law direct. So what happened was the first census in the United States was conducted under the direction of my guy Thomas Jefferson, who was then Secretary of State in 1790. The Constitution stipulated that it should be conducted within 3 years of the first meeting of Congress. It was actually conducted within a year. Data was collected on who was living in the United States at that time, although there were certain exclusions as well, which I think we'll get to. And censuses have been conducted every 10 years ever since. And they're, as historians, of great value to us as historians of the United States, but they're also really, really important politically. The reason this is in the Constitution is because it's about allocating representatives in the House of Representatives and so on, and government resources. So the censuses are really important tool of government, but it's also a really, really, as I said, it's a valuable tool to historians.
To be sure, but I think we should sort of unpack that first census a little bit.
Yes,
because the Constitution, in that longer bit where it sort of describes who's being counted.
Yes, I've got it in bold here.
You've got the full text, and watch read the full text in bold here, because I think that's worth unpacking.
Okay, so I will read the full clause, if you will. So this is Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution.
If you're reading along at home.
Yes, listeners, this is why you download our podcast, to hear me read the Constitution to you. President Trump might want to read it. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers. Now, I read that a moment ago. The next clause is quite controversial, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. Mm. The actual enumeration shall be made within 3 years after the first meeting of the Congress of the United States, and within every subsequent term of 10 years, in such manner as they shall by law direct. So the bit that's important there, and let me read it again, because it's actually complicated, and the language is confusing, because...
It's on purpose.
Which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. Mm. David, would you like to explain why that's important?
Well, that's the 3/5 clause, which was a compromise reached at the Constitutional Convention about when they were debating, okay, we're going to have representations proportional to the population, which people are we counting? One of the great ironies of the Constitutional Convention is that the slave states said, we want to count all the people, including the people who are property, and the people in the free states, and this is the point in which there are, you know, slavery is being abolished in the North. They say, no, we only want people who are free and, you know, full citizens or what have you to be counted as for the purposes of representation. And so the compromise...
For the purposes of taxation, however,
they want first.
So because Southerners said, no, don't count enslaved people for the purposes of taxation. And Northerners said, you've got to count them.
So they reached this compromise that they're going to count slaves for 3/5, so that there's some representation for slave owners get sort of bonus representation in some ways for the slaves that they own, which has consequences for the first 70 years, of which there are elections as a consequence of the ways in which slaves get slave owners extra votes.
Can I interrupt you and interject, I guess I should say, because this is a particular bugbear of mine.
Okay.
This really, really, really annoys me when people say the Constitution said that African Americans were 3/5 human.
Yeah, they don't say that.
That's not what it says. I mean, look, I'm not here to defend the framers of the Constitution, especially where slavery is concerned, but that is a shorthand, and one hears that all the time, often from well-educated people. Mm. That's not what it says. It's this compromise, as you very ably laid it out, over both representation and taxation, with the different regions, depending on how they felt about slavery, taking opposite positions.
Yeah.
So it's a political compromise. Why it's important in the context of this, our discussion today, is because I think the census has always been political at some level, and how you count people is...
makes a huge amount of difference, right?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And so because of the 3/5 compromise, the southern states in Congress but in the Electoral College had a built-in advantage. Mm. It's only when the northern population far outstrips the southern population in 1860, to make an electoral difference in 1860, that it causes a political crisis, because the southern states had this inbuilt advantage because of slavery.
Yeah.
The other thing I call your attention to is, of course, that phrase, and excluding Indians not taxed. So Native Americans were denied citizenship. They weren't taxed in the according to the federal constitution as originally adopted. And so we've got what we're seeing is, in that very first census, there are issues about who's being counted and who's not being counted. And perhaps unsurprisingly, these are tied very closely to issues of race.
To be sure. The other interesting thing, I think, when you go from what you have in 1787, where you have them drafting the document with those requirements that you just read, to actually implementing it in 1790, they actually decide to collect additional information, right? From the very beginning, they're collecting more data than what the Constitution requires.
And I think that's where we have to be grateful that Jefferson was the Secretary of State in 1790, because he loved data.
Well, so if you look, the first census you know, the Constitution requires basically
count the people.
Count the free people, count the slaves.
Yeah.
And that's the only data you need to actually do the calculations you need to, you know, according to the Constitution. In the first census, they collect the names of each of the heads of household. The Constitution doesn't say you have to do that. They count the number of free white men over and under the age of 16. That might be worth thinking about. The number of free white women, the number of free other people, and the number of slaves. So even from the very beginning, they're adding sort of additional... They're saying, okay, this is an opportunity for the government to collect additional information about our citizens. And we're thinking, you know, why are they collecting data about men above and below the age of 16? That probably has to do with military preparation and knowing how many people they can call upon for militias and those kinds of things. But what one sees, I think, in the census is, you know, a tool of the government that has this very specific constitutional purpose. But then other people are saying, but we can also use this as an opportunity to collect other data that the government might find valuable about its people.
There's also data about ethnicity and national identity as well, though.
Well, that not in the first census. It's the later censuses in the 19th century.
No. Because we've got data from the 1790 census on ethnicity.
Oh, okay. Because that's not according to the Census Bureau. That seems like that one shows up.
Well, certainly historians use that census to census to identify the national origins of people.
Okay.
So they may ask, I've got a confessor, they might have asked place of birth.
Oh, okay, yeah. Because it's what one looks, and the Census Bureau has a really great list of all the questions they ask. What one finds throughout the 19th century is a gradual sort of accumulation of additional questions.
Yeah, they always add things to it.
The level, the granularity, I guess, of the data becomes progressively more interesting.
Have you used the censuses for your own research?
I have.
Right, so tell me about that.
Well, so when you get to the censuses that are particularly interesting to me are the 1850 census and the 1860 census, because that's when they actually started to collect good data about slaves.
Right.
And so you can then use the slave schedules to calculate.
What do you mean by good data?
Well, so before they just calculate the number of slaves. When you get to 1850 and 1860, they start to collect the, you know, they have the ages of the slaves and they have the gender of the slaves. And so you can actually then sort of, you know, do some more fine granular assessment of how many people they own. Before that, they just say Thomas Jefferson owns 47 people.
Right.
Thomas Jefferson owned a lot more than that. Never mind. That's a bad example. But you can... You know, it allows you to sort of reconstruct family units sometimes, and they question, you know, the race of the slaves, and so you can look at, you know, people of different degrees of blackness there, at least the way that the census enumerated them. So I've used that some because they have occupational data, they have a data about the amount of property people own, and I think that's really helpful for doing, you know, certain kinds of social history.
Sure.
Because a lot of these people are otherwise invisible, right? I mean, this one of the great things about the census is it, you know, does for many Americans, this is the one time they actually show up in the historical record is when they appear in a census, and you can obviously sort of, because it happens every 10 years, you can follow them and sort of chart their lives through the census.
Yeah, it's great that it's decennial, but it's also great that the 10-year point falls at the beginning of a decade, seems to me. So thankfully, they started in 1790. So we have 1790, 1800, 1810, and so on. And so we're due. The reason this is in the news is because we're due for another census in 2020.
Yes. And so they're doing the sort of final test marketing for the new census.
So, David, you've... when we were discussing this before we went on air, we discussed the fact that I've never completed a census form in the United States because I've been abroad for most of my adult life. But you have. And in fact, you lamented that you didn't get to do the long form.
Yeah, well,
can you explain the short and long form?
Well, so I think they've actually done away with the long form now. But for a while, they in the late 20th and early part of the 21st century, had two versions of the census, the short form, which went to everybody, and then a slightly more detailed form that asked all kinds of weird questions about whether you own a car and how much insurance you have on your house and the length of your commute and other kinds of data. In thinking about, and I was sad because I got the short form and I really wanted to give the government all of my data because I thought that was exciting. I really wanted to be part of the data set that historians would use centuries later for understanding, you know.
Listeners, you can't see the expression on my face as David is saying this, but trust me. We'll do video.
I was young and naive when I really wanted to do the long form. Now I think I'd be a little bit more skeptical of it, but I think then I was enamored.
So what was your experience in doing this?
Well, no, I liked the idea of, you know, filling out the form and being part of this huge, you know, record that would be, you know, the interesting thing about one of the ways in which the census is interesting for historians is, you know, census data now is private, but it's only private for 72 years. And after 72 years, the data becomes public. And so you can go back and look at 72-year-old census data. And so they have sort of anniversaries when new stuff gets released, and it's very exciting.
Presumably that's because they assume 72 years is somebody's lifetime.
Yeah, that's the calculation when they made that determination in the 1970s, I believe that was the average life expectancy for women, and so they decided that was the term.
So I wonder if they'll raise it now that life expectancy
is much longer, yeah. They've actually announced sort of like when they're going to release the 2020 census eventually in
2092,
yes.
Well, yeah, I'll be just getting ready to retire at that point at this current rate.
with or without a pension, yeah.
One group of Americans are not counted. That's you and me now.
Oh, yes.
Because Americans abroad, Americans abroad are excluded from the census, private citizens abroad. So people who serve in the military or working for the government are included in the census. But we are the one category of Americans that are not theoretically excluded from the census. We're not counted.
No.
How do you feel about that?
Well, it's interesting because we do both of us vote, and so we are, you know, we have representation in Congress through our, you know, so it is a bit odd.
And there are, one of the reasons it's an estimate is because we're not counted, but there are, it is estimated, between 6 and 8 million Americans abroad, which would make us a medium-sized state.
Well, I mean, one of the things about the census is it's supposed to be an actual enumeration. And one of the consequences of that is that it's always an undercount. And the question is always, how much of an undercount is it and who is being undercounted? Right, and so we're not being counted because we're overseas. People who are homeless are often not counted. People who are minorities are often
undercounted.
Why is that?
Some
of it has to do with people who don't have a fixed address. Some of it has to do with people who don't return the form. Because if you don't return the form, the government, you know, the census taker. If someone's looking for a job, by the way, in 2 years, this is a, you know, job opportunity waiting for you. You know, a census taker will come to your house to collect the data if you don't return the form within a period of whatever time frame they give you. But the consequence of that is that middle class and wealthy people return the form much more often and are much more often to be home when the census taker comes to actually collect the data. So more migrant populations are less likely to be counted. And thinking about immigrant populations, are also, you know, more skeptical of the government. They're more skeptical of somebody knocking on their door asking for information.
From the government.
From the government, right? And so part of the controversy with the recent one has to do with the recent debate about citizenship.
We'll get to that in a second, although it occurs to me, as you say that one group that might be undercounted as well, though, are kind of people who are ideologically opposed to the government. Now
yes.
I'm thinking about the kind of right-wing militia types who distrust the government. I suspect they don't return their census forms either.
So, to be sure, right? I mean, I think there's always been a right-wing militia types aside, I think a skepticism about how this data is going to be used. And you see that actually in the very first census. Because if you think about what's going on in 1790, you know, somebody from the government coming to your house, you know, a federal government that you have very little connection with.
Would have been a federal marshal at that point.
Or a deputy of a federal marshal.
There was no census bureau.
You know, so a person coming up that you don't know trying to say, okay, I need, you know, your name and the number of people who live with you and how old they are and all these kinds, you know, there's a skepticism about that because censuses are often precursors for taxation. Censuses are often precursors for conscription, and so I think there's always been a general skepticism of the census and what these numbers are going to be used for. And some of this, I think, is pretty justified.
Yeah, let's not forget. I think I know the example you're going to give, but in 1790, that was only 15 years after the outbreak of a war that many Americans fought in, which began over suspicion of government and government taxation.
Sure.
And so the notion that the government was coming to count you in order, a new government was coming to count you in order to more efficiently tax you, mm-hmm. would have been quite upsetting to some Americans.
The Census Bureau has always tried to persuade people it's for their benefit, but I think they have to do that for a reason. I mean, there's the two big sort of examples you can think about here. One is during the Second World War, the federal government drew upon census data to help identify Japanese Americans for internment. And
smaller numbers of Germans and Italians as well.
To be sure. And that seems to be happening on a sort of widespread basis in California, where they get sort of block-level data of Japanese Americans. So the census supposedly wasn't supposed to give detailed information about people they take records from. But they said, actually, on this block, there are two Japanese American families. It makes it pretty easy for the government to identify who those are. And I think slightly later in Washington, D.C., they actually identified the names and addresses of some Japanese Americans for the for internment. And so that's a case where, the census was explicitly used by the government, not for the purposes of enumeration and getting sort of big data sets about how most Americans are doing or how many people are in different states, and so they can do that kind of apportionment, but actually to target specific individuals based on the data that those people gave to the government. And another sort of similar and somewhat less nefarious, but potentially so. In the 1950s, there was a movement to add religion as a question to the census. And it's an interesting moment. There's a really great Journal of American History article from about 12 years ago about this, who's the author of whose I now forget. I apologize. We'll look it up. I'll put it in the show notes. That the people pushing to add religion as a question were largely Catholic Americans. And the Catholic Church in particular said, look, we want to know where our parishioners are. We want to know, which states have the most Catholics. We want to make sure the Catholic population is recognized for as large as it is. And so part of why they wanted a question there is they said, we want to be identified because being identified will give us political power. The opposition to having religion listed was largely from Jewish Americans. We said, look, the Holocaust was very recent ago. Part of the ways in which the Nazis were able to identify Jewish people was through government records. And we refuse to fill out the census if we're required to answer our religious identity. And eventually the government decides to scuttle that particular plan to list religion.
Well, that brings us to the contemporary controversy that's kicked off in the past week, David, with this question about asking about citizenship.
Yes.
Now, on its face, and you and I have discussed this off air a little bit, on its face, that seems to me a reasonable question. I mean, we know that the Constitution just says you have to count the people. It doesn't say anything about nationality. But as our discussion has shown, from the outset, the census has had political implications. And questions have been added over the years. One could argue, in fact, I think I would argue, on its face, this is good to know and should be unobjectionable. Why is it controversial? Why do people have a problem with it?
Why it's controversial, there are lots of American families right now that have some people in it who are legal residents of the United States, some of them who are citizens of the United States, maybe some people in the family who are not legal residents of the United States. Form comes to your house, starts to ask, are you a citizen? You might say, yes, I'm a citizen, but my grandmother is not a citizen. She lives with us. Do I want to put her down or not? What happens if I don't put her down? What's the consequence for all of us? And so what you end up potentially happening in that situation is an undercount not only of the total population, but actually of the total number of citizens, because certain categories of citizens are less likely to fill that out, because they're worried not only about themselves, they're worried about other members of their families, they're worried about their neighbors, they're worried about government agents showing up, asking them questions about their citizenship status. They're worried about, will the Census Bureau communicate with immigration and border control? So there's all kinds of ways in which, you know, immigrant communities are particularly concerned, you know, not only for those people who may not have legal status, but for those people who do have legal status and are citizens, may not fill out their forms and consequently will be underrepresented in Congress. You know, if you're thinking about states with large immigrant populations, places like California, they're worried that, you know, they're going to get less representation in Congress. There's going to be less federal money going to them as a consequence. So there are meaningful political consequences, not only for those people who are, you know, filling out the form or not filling out the form, but for broader communities as well.
Right. But I think the strongest of those criticisms, the one I'm most sympathetic to, is the what use will government agents use put what use will they use? Sorry, I'm misspeaking here. How will they use this data?
Yeah.
And given the kind of overreach of ICE, the Immigration and Customs, what does the E stand for in ICE, agents, when it comes to deporting folks, including American citizens or the relatives of American citizens, I think that skepticism is well-founded. So I'm to some extent playing devil's advocate here. But the question was asked on the long form until 1950. It hasn't been asked since 1950. It's been asked on the American Community Survey, which is something the government also runs. It's not...
it's not the same.
It's not the same as the census, but it's been asked. It's always asked there. And it was asked on the short form until 2010, according to the Census Bureau. From 1910 to 2010, so it was only removed recently. And so I wonder if the... So I'm broadly sympathetic to the critique you've just given, but to some extent, that critique is of this moment and the distrust that many people feel of the Trump administration.
Well, and if you actually look 10 years ago, there was lots of distrust of the census by Republicans who were worried
that's why the question was removed.
So there was lots of questions that they, you know, took off the census in part because Republicans said this is government invasion of privacy and what have you. I think at this particular moment we're in terms of the amount of trust people have in the census and in the government more broadly, I think this is a kind of question that's going to be extraordinarily divisive because it's a crime not to fill out your census form. You know, if you get the form and you don't fill it out because you don't feel comfortable answering the questions and you don't want to tell them how much, whether you're a citizen or not, or how long your commute is, or what are the various questions they get asked.
You've completed your census form. Yeah. I haven't. Do you have to fill out every question?
Yes. If you don't fill out any of the questions, that's, in theory, a crime. You could theoretically go to jail for it. Nobody does.
Yeah, when was the last time somebody was jailed for not filling out the census?
I have no idea. But, it does give...
Ha! That's his Leif Erikson question.
That's my Leif Erikson question. The amount I don't know vastly exceeds, Frank, the amount that I do know. I think it's... I think it's really important that the census works well because, you know, if we don't get a good count, the consequences of that are astronomical for apportionment of Congress in terms of allocation of resources, in terms of the fight over gerrymandering that's been going on. Getting the right number matters tremendously. And I think anything that we do that dissuades people from returning their census form, you know, is really sort of poison to the whole system, because this is really one of the bedrock things the whole system works on. People don't trust that their census data is going to be used for their benefit. They're not going to fill out the form. And given how little trust Americans have in government on either side of the aisle right now, I think politicizing the census more than it's already politicized, and as we've talked about, it's always been political.
Yeah, it's political by nature.
It is political by nature, but, you know, at least, you know, if it's the extent to which it is explicitly being used for political ends, you know, and when thinking about this citizenship question, I think part of this is, you know, an effort to try to dissuade non-citizens from staying in the country, or people whose immigration status is you know, in a gray area, from staying in the country. I think it's an effort to scare people.
Could be. What if, for example, it turns out that the question we're asked, and it turns out there are far fewer illegal immigrants in the country than Donald Trump and his supporters believe?
Well, of course.
In fact, because of the underreporting that's likely to be a consequence of this question, that's almost an inevitable outcome.
Oh, sure. And the answer will be yes, there are zero illegal immigrants, because no one's going to put a check on their box on a government form that says, I'm an illegal immigrant.
Right, of course. Problem solved.
Exactly.
Say he solved it.
Number of illegal immigrants went to zero. But then you end up with California with, you know, three fewer congressional seats.
And Texas.
And, you know, and not only those in terms of the large states, but also think about the ways in which those states get gerrymandered and the ways in which, you know, certain, you know, parts of states get overrepresented in Congress, and way in certain demographic groups get overrepresented in Congress, and in state legislatures, which is also the next sort of level of gerrymandering. That's really dangerous, I think.
I mean, you've persuaded me that this is a bad idea.
Persuaded Frank of something. That's
good. Historian in me thinks this would be good data to have.
Oh, to be sure. We want all the data.
In itself, it shouldn't be a problematic question. But I understand that
who's asking the question.
Which gets us to the fact we don't trust people with our data, so maybe it's time to pivot to Facebook. And the use of our data by private entities more generally, but before we do that, did you see the cushion that Mark Zuckerberg was sitting on when he testified before Congress?
Yes, I did. So he's not a tall man.
Yes, neither you nor I are tall.
That's
so
true.
So did you feel sympathy for Mark Zuckerberg in that case or not?
I felt sympathy for Mark Zuckerberg in as much as he was trying to explain Facebook to a bunch of 70-year-old men who didn't understand.
Oh, that was hilarious. It was hilarious. I don't know whether any of them actually called it the Facebook.
Yeah. Well, it originally was the Facebook, but, you know, back in the day. Before Sean Parker told him to change the name. I had sympathy for him in as much as sitting in front of Congress and being interrogated by hostile questions about Diamond and Silk, or whatever the hell the Facebook group is that he was being questioned about, YouTube celebrities. That's an unpleasant experience. I can't think of anyone who's gone before Congress and raved about its experience afterwards, at least not honestly.
At least he wasn't sitting on a phone book.
The man's a billionaire. He can afford.
He can afford to bring a cushion with him.
Exactly. But you know, I think Facebook is in a long line of companies collecting data on consumers. Sort of the private collection of data. If we think about the census as being sort of the most visible way in which the government's collecting data on us, although there's lots of other ways government's collecting data on us. Government's listening to our phone calls and other things. The private collection of data is potentially just as dangerous, or dangerous maybe in a different way.
Have you ever looked for something on Amazon, and then when you log into another website, the ad that appears on the side is what you were looking for?
Everyone has had that happen to them, Frank. Yes, okay, yes. We've all had this experience. We understand how the internet...
It was a rhetorical question, David. You don't have to be snarky.
Unlike people in Congress, Frank, I think our listeners understand how the internet works.
Okay.
Or at least enough to know that cookies follow us around. If we're thinking about when the sort of private collection of data begins, I think maybe a good place to start would be Lewis Tappan's Mercantile Agency.
Tell us about Lewis Tappan's.
So Lewis Tappan is most famous today as
the Tappan Zee Bridge.
Sorry. Yes, that. But among people who are interested in the history of abolition, he and his brother Arthur are early abolitionists who are also not only abolitionists but also super wealthy, and so they're able to finance, or one of the sort of early financial backers of people like Garrison. But his mercantile agency was basically the idea was that if you're going into business with somebody you didn't know, where could you go to find out about whether that person was a good person to do business with? And so it's basically an early credit reporting agency. And, you know, it starts in the 1840s. By 1860, he's got something in the order of 2,000 correspondents spread throughout the country who are writing reports on local businessmen describing, you know, how basically how creditworthy they are. And they're describing whether they are timely of paying their debts. They're describing whether they are considered to be honest brokers in business, whether they're alcoholics, whether they like to gamble a lot, all these kinds of factors. So much so that by the, you know, the end of the 19th century, you actually have several of these credit reporting agencies, most of which are based in New York, that have a huge amount of data on private citizens, on their business, on how much money they have, where they bank, who they do business with. And you would go to one of these private reporting agencies and say, look, I'd like information on John Smith, who lives in Louisiana, and a clerk would go back into the back, get a big leather volume, and read you the reports from the past 5 or 6 years about this guy in Louisiana you wanted to know details about. And, you know, if you think about how that sort of migrates into the 20th century, you end up with these enormous credit reporting agencies that have enormous amounts of data about Americans, about, you know...
And enormous amounts of power over...
Yes, as a consequence of that, right? You know, and this is a power dynamic that is very much sort of a one-way power dynamic. They have all this data. Oftentimes, the people who have the data collecting about them don't know the data is being collected about them and don't have ability recourse if the data being collected about them is incorrect. So, you know, thinking about the mercantile agency, if your report says you're an alcoholic, it almost doesn't matter whether you're an alcoholic or not because your report says you are, and that's what people will be using to make judgments about you. You know, thinking about the one of the barriers, though, to sort of information collection throughout the 19th century, whether it's private collection by people like Lewis Tappan or Dun and Bradstreet, which ends up becoming the big credit agency by the end of the 19th century, is actually how you manage this information. You know, Dun and Bradstreet used to have these big leather-bound volumes that you'd have to go and go to New York to access, and actually collecting the data was extraordinarily difficult. The Census Bureau had the same problem. How do you process all this data? It often took them 10 years to process the census so they could actually get the data from it because it was all done by hand. In 1890, the invention of punch cards, you know, which we think of as being this extraordinarily antiquated technology, was extraordinarily influential in allowing government and business to record a huge amount of data on individual people. And what one sees, I think, after the invention of the punch card in 1890, and then obviously later with computers of different forms in the 20th century, is both the amount of data people have and the way they're able to access it and the speed they're able to access it is increasing exponentially. Thinking about, though, the credit reporting, one of the pivotal moments here, I think, is actually, and ways in which these two things are intersecting, starts in 1936 when the Social Security Bureau starts to issue Social Security numbers. Because one of the things that does is it then gives everybody a unique identifier. Right? You know, there are lots of John Smiths, and there may even be other Frank Coglianos out there.
Say that, so, David.
They pale in imitation to the, you know.
There's a jazz musician.
There is. Yeah, and you often get confused?
Not often. Occasionally I get asked if I'm a musician.
Musician, ah. And your answer?
Well, no. some sort of witty answer about how lyrical I am.
But yes, anyway. Yeah.
Is there another David Silkenau?
No, I am uniquely fortunate or unfortunate in as much as I cannot say, oh, that's the other David Silkenau, because they're... Silkenet is a uniquely unusual name. But for the thousands of John Smiths out there, you know, the Social Security number and the creation of it allowed, you know, first the government, but then later credit reporting agencies and other businesses to identify individual John Smiths as distinct people. You know, one of the things the credit bureaus were able to do as the Social Security number became a more ubiquitous form of identification is they're able to sort of piece together more and more data about people. So, you know, especially during the 70s and 80s and 90s, you had to put your Social Security number down on everything that you, every form you filled out, whether it's a credit card application, whether it's signing up for school, whether it's, you know, enrolling in getting a Sears card or something. And so, it became the vehicle through which an enormous amount of data gets aggregated. And as a consequence of that, you know, these credit bureaus had enormous amount of power over, you know, individuals, because they knew not only, you know, who you were and where you were born, how much money you made. They also knew what magazines you subscribed to. They know where you shopped. You know, they were able to engage in this kind of mass data sort of analysis that Facebook is doing now, but on a slightly different scale. But has consequences for who gets credit, who doesn't get credit, who gets mortgages, you know, who gets jobs, all these kinds of things. And so it's enormous power. And this is data that, you know, thinking about comparing it to Facebook, people are very concerned about this Cambridge Analytica leak or data dump. Experian, I think one of the large credit reporting agencies, had an even larger breach a couple of years ago with actually much more critical data in it, in terms of people's financial information, where their bank account numbers are, what their Social Security numbers are, how much money they earn, what their credit rating is. All that is far more potentially damaging than somebody, you know, getting my Facebook data and finding out where I went on holiday 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's interesting because, I mean, thanks for that, because that's a really good background of the kind of corporate use of data and the fact that it goes back much longer than many people assume. The Cambridge Analytica stuff is a little bit interesting. It's interesting to me on all kinds of levels. It's interesting to me in part because I'm not sure they had that much of an influence on the election, frankly. And indeed, it's in their interest to claim they did because they're running a business themselves. And of course, Facebook is in the business, as Mark Zuckerberg told Congress this week, of harvesting data and selling it. That's their product, essentially. But we willingly give them that data. And we willingly share all kinds of data on social media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or what have you. And some people say, I'm giving up Facebook and going to Instagram. Well, Facebook owns Instagram.
You know? Or I'll go to Twitter, which is much better. Right.
And, you know,
by the way, everyone should follow us on Twitter and like
us on
Facebook. Yes.
And, you know, we all happily tick the box saying we accept the terms and conditions on websites without reading the terms and conditions.
To be sure.
And yet, so we volunteer. So there's a kind of, I agree with you. I think the private collection of data by corporations seeking to profit from that data is particularly problematic. We seem much more skeptical about surrendering information to the government, which theoretically is us and exists to protect us at some level, than we do when surrendering our data with relatively little concern to private entities. So I think I'm fascinated by this contrast.
Well, and thinking about that, I've been thinking about that contrast too, because one of the distinctions, and I don't know whether one of the ideas that I'm playing with and thinking about this, and I'm curious what you're thinking about this is, Americans are more concerned about government having our data and seem somewhat laissez about corporations having our data. Europeans seem to be in the reverse position, where they are much more willing to give government data or allow government data to be harvested in various ways. Thinking about, you know, even the ways in which they collect taxes in Europe, it tends to be very, very different because of the way the data is harvested from employers and employees. But privacy protections from corporations are much stricter in Europe than they are in the United States.
That's right. So on the web, for example, the European Union has much stricter privacy laws
than the United States. And the United States almost has, you know, comparatively none in terms of data protection and who owns our data and the ways in which corporations can use our data. And I'm not quite sure exactly how to sort of explain that dichotomy if or that sort of American exceptionalism, if we're going to sort of go down that
angle. Or European exceptionalism. I mean, it's a contrasting view.
To be sure.
So, I think there's, having lived here slightly longer than you, I think there's a... there's a greater trust of the state.
Mm.
Not saying that Europeans love the state or trust the state necessarily, but they tend to do so more than Americans do. There's a libertarian streak. We've talked about this on the pod before. Mm. There's a libertarian streak that runs through American politics and American culture, going back to the revolution.
Yes.
And this revolution against government that's been there on the left and the right from the beginning and is part of the political DNA in the United States that is not as pronounced. It came from Britain, so there is an element of it here.
But it was a fringe movement.
Yeah, it was a fringe movement in Britain. It became the mainstream in the United States, and it's one of the really significant differences, I think, in ideology, at least, between Americans and Europeans.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other part of that, I think, is Americans, not only do they not trust the government, there's a part of the American ethos that trusts capitalism to work well, and they say, look, Facebook's not going to misuse our data because it's not in their financial interest to misuse our data and lose our trust.
Or if they do, the market will correct.
The market will correct for all things. Because
so theoretically, people should leave Facebook, and then Facebook will
change,
become more responsible. That seems unlikely to happen. What tends to happen is when these kind of things erupt, Facebook says it's sorry. It's very interesting that they bought full page advertisements to apologize in the New York Times and the Washington Post and places like that, because I think those apologies were aimed at, you'd think if Facebook wanted to communicate with people, they'd have to do stuff. But the reason they did that, I think, was it was aimed at those 70-year-old men in Congress saying, don't regulate us, we'll handle this, we're very, very sorry. And what's tended to happen is Facebook apologizes, the thing blows over, and the billion-plus people who use it still use it. Some people go off, but the vast majority go on. And the number of users continues to increase, and Facebook goes merrily along.
Yeah.
So, I think your European-American contrast is really interesting, especially because, of course, there are profound socialist movements in most European countries, and socialist movements are premised on correcting the excesses and opposing the excesses of capitalism, and the corporations are villains in that piece, and so there's a greater distrust of corporations. What I find interesting in this, and we probably need to wrap up, is how we've decided, at least on the internet and in social media, that some corporations are good and some are bad. So Google's got more data on all of us probably than Facebook
does. Yeah, well, their motto is do no evil.
Right, and people have tended to believe that. Where there's skepticism about Facebook. We're all on Facebook, but we hate Facebook. Most people, Google...
I don't hate Facebook. Facebook, if you're listening, I don't hate Facebook.
I find Mark Zuckerberg annoying and his cushion. if you're short, embrace it. I'm on a couch right now below David, and the feng shui here is very bad, but I'm not sitting on a cushion. But we've decided some corporations are okay, and some websites and some apps and so on. And so, it's like, why did everybody hate Microsoft but love Apple? And similarly, Facebook gets more of a rough ride than, say, Google does. I think that's a safe statement. And that just fascinates me as to how that ecology has evolved. And I don't have an answer for that. I simply observe it.
All right. Time for last drops, Frank. What do you got?
For our listeners in New York or anybody going to New York, there's a really interesting exhibition in the New York Public Library on 42nd and 5th, the main library.
With the Lions and Ghostbusters.
Yes, on the 1960s. It's not huge. It's right on the ground floor. It's free, open to the public. It's great. There's some, they've shared some of their treasures in terms of ephemera, posters and buttons and things like that. There's a music section to it. It's really, really interesting. I know that you and I are both Bob Dylan fans. They have the manuscript lyrics for Changing of the Guards.
Hmm.
Slightly problematic because, of course, that appeared on his 1978 album Street Legal, so it's not a 1960s song.
Details.
And they draw a kind of tangential link to the 1960s, and that basically say, hey, here's a 1960s guy, here's this manuscript song we have.
Hmm.
But just to see the manuscript and how it evolved, because it's all marked up and things like that. Anyway, if you're in New York and it's lunchtime and you're wandering around, drop in and have a look at this exhibition. It's really
excellent.
Good. What about you, David?
So I want to recognized the demise of an iconic, if generally bad, American candy. That is the Necco wafer.
Oh!
Now,
oh!
The Necco wafer, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is...
Oh!
Frank is lamenting here the demise of the Necco wafer, which is from Revere, Massachusetts. So a hometown product for him. So Frank...
New England, baby. Black Necco wafers are awesome.
Can you describe, for those listeners who have not had a Necco wafer, can you describe what these things are?
It's a small disc of flavored sugar.
Yes.
It's kind of like communion host, if you... But it's sweet.
Okay, so the body of Christ.
Sorry, if that's kind of religious to people, I apologize. We're going to have to issue another apology next week. It's the last drop that always gets us, David.
But the Necco wafers are originated in 1847. They don't seem to have evolved much at all since then.
What does Necco stand for, David?
I have no idea what Necco stands
for. New England Confectionery Company.
New England Confectionery Company. They were used by Civil War soldiers because they never go bad, so it's like... hardtack, but with sugar. And it's a product that I think has been on store shelves for more than 150 years. Sometimes it's
throughout
the same.
My childhood.
Sometimes it's the same ones from 1847 that are still there because nobody buys the damn stuff. But they are stopping producing them, which has caused a run on the remaining Necco wafers. So, you know, if you want to have a chance to sample them before they become discontinued, go and see if you can hunt some out.
If they come for my fluffanutta, I'm going to be really angry. That's all I'm going to say. New England culture has to be preserved.
On that note, cheers.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.